be permitted to die in the service. Their relatives will not get any money, will not get any revenue because of their genetic mistakes. However, get the very latest news and traffic together when you wake up with us. What a joke. If Lenny Bruce were alive, what material. My God, what material. I wonder if the VC and the NBA used to say, wait a minute, don't shoot that guy, he's gay.
Yeah, you sound like you might be from New York.
Oh boy, am I from New York. I was from, not New York, Brooklyn. New York is different. The people always confuse that. When I was a little boy, New York was a different place. That was a journey. That was an odyssey. And if you dated a girl, the father said, okay, how do you get to New York? Well, I take the West End subway. I get off at 42nd Street. Then what? Then I go upstairs, cross the street, and we go to see Benny Goodman at the Paramount. And he said, and then what time do you get out? I said, well, there's a movie show that your daughter might want. The first girl I was crazy about was named Myra Werner. Her father was connected with Murder Incorporated obliquely, you know. But when it came to the offspring, you know, very careful. And I said, well, we'll see it. I don't know what the movie is, and we'll probably be 3 hours, and then what? And I said, then we cross, and you remember Toffanetti's, you're too young. There was a place called Toffanetti's that was famous for baked potatoes. So I said, we'll go to Toffanetti's, have a baked potato, was 15 cents or something, which was a lot. And 38, 39, and then you'd have a hot chocolate, and they're still around, that Schraff's. And then we go down the subway, and we come home. And he says, and then you get to 86th Street, right? I said, right, and then what? I said, and then we'll walk to 77th Street, and she'll be home. What time? 7 o'clock, 6 o'clock, not too late. It's dark. But New York, when you cross that bridge, that was a journey. I mean, people confuse Brooklyn with New York. Brooklyn is provincial. This whole thing about the Brooklyn wise guy is just an invention of Warner Brothers and John Garfield and that whole, you know, we made all those submarine movies and everything. Nonsense. We didn't know what was going on the block around the corner. I mean, we played stickball in the summer and ice hockey on skates in the winter, and we followed the Dodgers, and to go to Ebbets Field was a shrine. I mean, it was a temple. It was theological. And Joe DiMaggio, I mean, and big band swing and Hitler and politics and stuff. I don't remember ever coming into our consciousness until the first thing that ever came into my consciousness was the Spanish Civil War, because, and I use it in the novel, because there was a brother and sister who lived next door to us named Shulman, Zal and Rebecca Shulman. They went off in the Lincoln Brigade. He was an intern at Bellevue. She was a nurse, and they were in the Lincoln Brigade, and he came back blind. And as a child, I mean, the shock of seeing this healthy, handsome young man blind. His sister, she was okay. I never forgot that. But my parents weren't political, but a lot of my friends' parents were. Socialism was the thing, Marxism, Durruti, the anarchist, and the Bulganin, was that his name? The Russian that evolved anarchy, and that anarchism was the way. No governments. There should never be any kind of government. People must learn to get along with each other and somehow get through the day without any rules. Buchanan, that was his name. Stalin had him killed in the purge of the 30s, but my family wasn't political. I mean, my father studied opera, and he he had a pharmacy, and I didn't really know. He died very young. And when I was in the Navy, he died. And my mother was sort of a flapper that never grew up, you know. I remember them going to places, speakeasies out on the island, a place called Felix's, way out on the island, and dancing the Black Bottom on the table and all that stuff. That Charleston, you know.
I have a feeling that the Brooklyn that you described a moment ago doesn't really exist anymore.
Maybe not, but Bensonhurst does, because when I was researching a story that they're going to make at Warner Brothers called about Paul Castellano, his demise, his, you know, the John Gotti, victim of Gotti's insanity. It's called Boss of Bosses. It was a book written by two FBI men. And I had to do a little research. Went out to Bensonhurst, absolutely unchanged. Only it used to be 50-50 Jews and Italians. Now it's almost 80-20, I guess, Italians to Jews. But the street's the same. The houses are the same. And if you had period cars, you could shoot 1938 and had no trouble at all. It's amazing how little it's changed.
I noticed...
Now, I don't know what the philosophy of life is. I don't know what the cultural shocks have been or any of that. But it looked like the same old middle-class thing that I grew up in. I went to my old house, and I walked in the alley, went towards the back because there was a cherry tree we used to climb as kids to see if the tree was still there. And some lady, I heard her saying, there's some guy in the alley. And there across the street is the classic Return from Hollywood. It's a limo that Paramount provided, and Betty, my wife, was in it. And she says, some guy in the bathroom. And she comes to the door, and an old Italian woman, she says, can I do something for you? And I said, well, I lived here a long time ago, and I just wanted to see if it was all still here. She said, what's your name? I said, Steve Shagan. She says, well, we bought this from the Summersteins in 1948 or 9. I said, I remember the Summersteins. Are any of them? She said, they're all dead. She says, you want to come in for coffee? I said, sure. And they were very nice, very kind. But they were the same people. Do you know what I mean? And it didn't seem to me anything changed. And she says, what's the limousine across the street? Where'd you get that? I said, well, I work for Paramount. I didn't want to say Hollywood, you know. They provided a car. I said, and my wife's a very rich lady. She says, she Italian? I said, yes. And she is. She says, where's she from? I said, Boston. Does she know? She started to name Italians. I said, I don't know, really. I never asked her. But it was amazing in the sense that it was the same. And I was thinking, boy, you could do a film about Brooklyn in the 30s and have no trouble. All you need are period clothes, period cars, and you got it. I mean, when I was a kid, the milk was delivered by horse and wagon, Sheffield Farms, in bottles. And in the winter, the cream rose and the top always popped off. But you could hear the clip-clop at 4:30 in the morning. Railway Express were electric cars on wooden wheels, by the way, green and little red thing, Railway Express. Do you remember? No, you're all too young. And then the iCash clothesman would come, the Iceman. We had ice boxes, a Philco radio that worked forever. I mean, things worked. The toaster worked. They don't work today. We have some toaster that's always burning. It never works. And we never had a car. The telephone worked, easy to use. You called an operator and asked her, she got you the number. People used to be involved in life in a way. And now it's machines. And... it was happy. I mean, I have fond memories of Brooklyn. It was innocent. I mean, we didn't know about drugs or booze or, I mean, we knew there had been prohibition. My father used to drink pretty heavily, but I mean, we didn't know about a lot of things. And
when did you go to California?
1956.
Was there a culture shock as far as you were concerned?
Only in the sense that life seemed a lot easier. Only in that sense. I mean, by then I had been in the Navy for 3 years. I mean, I had seen a little bit and been to Italy and Germany and was working as a stagehand when I got out. Said that means local one here in New York. You do everything from ice shows to the old Metropolitan Opera to theater. I worked at the Imperial Theater on Broadway. I remember a show called Jamaica with Lena Horne and Ricardo Montalban. And then I printed film. I belonged to local 802, I guess it was, a film lab. And I'd go to Harlem at night after the curtain came down, 11:20 or whatever the hell it was, and I'd go to Harlem to Pathé and print film all night. So I worked two jobs in order to get enough money together to go to the coast. We didn't know anybody out there. And had a little MG and a cat. And we went across the country. And I got to California, and I went to the sister local, 33, the stagehands local, and they kept me busy. You know, it's striking. You never got the real good calls, but you'd strike the Jack Benny show or whatever, and moving scenery around. And then when they heard they understood I could run a front light and knew how to handle an electric console, I began to get some good calls. You know,
You've always been in movies, then, haven't you?
Well, around it, yeah. And the writing was something I did really for myself. I mean, they were sketches. If I were a painter, I would have made a thousand black and white sketches of things, you know, that I remembered, that stayed in my mind. And from things that were just mundane, I mean, an automobile maybe, to guys on a beach screaming for help, to sensual things, anything that attracted me, a girl's face, a profile, or whatever. I never showed it to anybody. And when I got out, the thing that really helped me was I worked a show called Danger, which was a half-hour show, live. Nothing was taped. And right after the war, it was about 49 or 50, maybe 50, maybe that late. I don't remember. Sidney Lumet did a lot of them, the director. Marty Ritt did a lot of them, and they were very well written. Patty Chayefsky, one of the main writers, Rod Serling. And I showed one of my, I wrote a two-page sketch about something, and I showed it to Rod, and he said, "Jesus, kid, you can write." He said, "Well, why don't you go to the coast?" He said, "All of this is going to go to film. Live television is over for all practical purposes. Why don't you go to California? Write one of those series. Do something. You can do it." And I said, "Gee, I don't know." And then my wife said, "Why not? Let's try." So we went out there, and then I kept, the stagehands kept me alive, you know, with food and sustenance. And then I'd write in the off hours, and I finally, the first thing I sold was a story to a show called Have Gun, Will Travel. I don't know if that's before your time.
No, Richard Boone was in it.
Right. It wouldn't let me do the teleplay. There were two producers, I remember, because they said, "You've never done one." You know, it was Catch-22. So I said, "But if you don't let me do it, I'll never do one, you know." And they said, "No, you did the story. We'll give it to a, you know," and I have staff writers. But then I went from that into publicity. I don't remember exactly how it happened. Somebody called up somebody at Universal and said, "This guy can write. He'd be great in unit publicity, you know, where you get the screenplay before the film starts, and then you go all the way through when they cast it and make it, and all the way to the box office, and just try your best to get anything you can in print about that film. You know, you write feature stories." And I got my first steady job at Paramount. A fellow named Herb Steinberg hired me, tough guy, and I was surrounded by brilliant journalists, you know, John and Ann Del Valle, Milt Watt, Max St. John's, who's now head of the publicists in Hollywood, who's had a booze problem at the time. We all had some problem, but he was a witty guy, you know. I can remember, for instance, and it was a happy time at Paramount. I mean, Jerry Lewis and Dean Martin were big stuff. I mean, they were Paramount. Elvis had just come out. Carol Baker was there. The Hal Wallace unit was still there. Ava Gardner. Duke Wayne's company, they always wanted me on all of Duke's pictures. And I was pretty, I mean, I did my job, you know, and there was no such thing as a bad movie, I remember that. Herb called us all in and said, "We don't make bad pictures. Those people that try to get these films made keep us alive. That's where we get our checks. There's no bad picture, no such thing as a bad picture at Paramount." And it's kind of a family feeling. It was fun to be on that lot at the time. And anecdotally, I remember when Joe Levine, do you remember him? He was a big impresario and Hercules Unchained and all that. And also did some very, very financed or partially financed, and certainly brought him to America, some extraordinary Italian movies, De Sica's stuff and early Fellini. And, you know, he was not a man of gross tastes, presumably, only in America. I mean, but he had the good sense to get some terrific stuff from Italy. And he had bought the hottest novel since Gone with the Wind, Carpetbaggers, Harold Robbins' Carpetbaggers. And he was coming to California and doing it at Paramount. And it was the book had a lot of Sturm und Drang, because there's a lot of sex and what was considered very almost pornographic in those days. And we were going to make a big announcement. And Herb called us all together. None of this has anything to do with the novel, but has everything to do with it, because it's some of the madness that... In other words, to exist in the movies in Hollywood, you have to accept insanity as normality and put blinkers on and go. You just don't... We were all sitting around his office. There's some terrific guys in that room. And Herb said, Joe's coming out with Harold. We got to do something big. It's got to be big. And we're all looking at each other with a sense of bemusement, because Herb himself was certainly not a rocket scientist. I mean, what Herb really knew how to do was to fix trouble. From murder to homosexuals was never mentioned in those days. He fixed things. His favorite saying, it isn't who you know, it's what you know about them. That was his
he's in your novel.
Yeah. And a lot of people I met, but not with viciousness. I mean, there's a little love in that novel about the whole thing, you know, the magic of it all. I hope so. I mean, it's not vicious. It's funny. And he said, we got to do something big. And we sat there. And then Mac sort of winked at me and he said, Herb, let's get elephants. Elephants. So Herb says, well, what are you talking about? This isn't got anything to do with a jungle. He says, but it's big. It's big, Herb. And Joe is big. Elephants. We have two elephants outside Chasen's restaurant with big gold things over their backs embroidered that says, Welcome to California. Paramount welcomes Joe Levine. And the other one says, The Carpetbagger's Harold Robbins, you know. Elephants, huh? He says, it's big. It's big. And then we start a gag going, and John Del Valle says, and at the same time, Herb, we have a plane, an airplane that does, you know, the smoke letters, the letters in smoke, Skyrider, and it says, Happy Birthday, Joe. And Herb says, it's not his birthday. What does it matter? He'll get a kick out of it. You know, everybody's cuckoo now. So he says, I don't know about happy birthday. What does it say? Why don't we just say, Hooray for Joe. Now, I said, it lacks a certain panache. I think Mac is right. Happy birthday, Joe. So, and then he says, girls. Gotta have girls. And we all were caught short with that one. He says, you're right, Herb, we need girls. He says, this is a sexy book. So he says, what do we do about girls? He says, call the Screen Extras Guild and get 20 or 30 girls, have them scantily clad. He said, gold lame costumes. They'll march down the street as Joe gets out of the limo, the elephants, the guy will go over, hooray for Joe, everything. He says, done. We go. The plane must have gone over on another day, because that never showed up, right? The limo comes. Joe steps out of the car. At that moment, and I don't know if this is fit for the air, but it's a natural function of physiological function, both elephants decide to eliminate whatever they had for breakfast that morning. And when an elephant eliminates what he ate for breakfast, it's a major eruption, you know. As Joe gets out, and it's monumental, it's big. And the girls are marching around this whole thing. The train has gone nuts to try to stop this. And Joe looks, and he looks at Harold, and he said, what the blankety blank's going on here? Who's in charge? And Herb is crazed. So he said, well, Joe, we had, and he says, get into Chasen's. He says, let's get this thing on. He says, what is this with elephants? He says, what's the plane? Someone told me there was an airplane here. Who brought all these these golden girls and the elephants? He says, it's a disgrace. And the TV guys were having a picnic. You know, the newsmen that cut. I forgot about that. We had about 100 newsmen all over the world. And it was that kind of madness, you know, that when you were very young and you were in it and you got accustomed to it. And especially when you went on location, when everybody, you have 40 or 45 magicians, each with their own act to perform, props, wardrobe, makeup, lights, actors, directors, sound men. And what happens is you're dumped in a hotel, as I've had in the novel. I mean, Cast of Thousands is almost an academic book about making movies, too. I mean, it's really the way it's made. It's not, I just don't talk about backstage stuff. I take him on the stage. I wanted people really to go from the inception of the idea through the insane story conferences all the way to the location, on the set, filming, to the box office. Because I haven't read that novel, and I thought it was something I knew how to do. And
question that you certainly drew on your experience.
Halfway successful.
But you must have seen a lot of changes, though, in the way movies are made over the years.
Yeah. I remember the old days at Paramount. You didn't seem to have excesses, in a sense. I mean, it was... And you got fast answers. They didn't fool around. You didn't have... Today, if you submit a screenplay, there's a thing called the Creative Committee. It's like the Inquisition without hoods. You never know who they are. It doesn't have names. And they give you a critique on the screenplay. They also give you the list of people who should be in the movie. And we didn't have that. I mean, there was a man at the studio who said... Make the picture. Try to make it on time. Don't embarrass me, fellas. And you go. And it was more of an intimate kind of joint responsibility. And
These older movie companies are kind of like repertory companies, weren't they?
Yeah, exactly. You had the same... Exactly. It's a very cogent comment because they had... I remember... People didn't want to leave the lot. In other words, Duke was always there, the John Wayne Company. Hal Wallace was always there. Dean and Jerry had a million offers to go elsewhere. They never left Paramount. It was a repertory company, and you knew everybody. If you needed a piece of wardrobe or another sound machine or a boom or a Chapman crane, you knew who to call.
Of course, in your novel, the movie company in the book, has to reach out for everything, reach out for independent directors and producers and actors.
Well, what's happened are the studios are banks. They don't make movies, they finance movies. Big difference. In the old days, when I started as a young man, they made the pictures. In other words, they, meaning the people that ran the studios, would come on the stage and ask the producer, do you have everything you need? Is there anything we can do? We didn't like the dailies. They weren't always positive. So we'd like you to reshoot yesterday's dailies. We think that the performances weren't there. And then there'd be a little argument, but they'd give you the money to reshoot. You go to preview. We'd preview in Santa Barbara in those days. If the preview didn't work and you had to reshoot an end many times, shot new endings, brought everybody back and did it over again, and the money was there. And they didn't have cable to fall back on, and they didn't have cassettes to fall back on. I mean, you had to play in the theater. And they had a big edge, too, because they still owned their theaters, you know, up to 47, and then they had 5 years to divest or whatever it was. That was a big edge, because no matter how bad the movie was, you knew you were going to play in 15,000 situations. Today, each studio fights the other for key dates. Play dates of the ball game. You must get, and today you got a weekend. I mean, the life of a movie is that weekend. On Friday afternoon, if a new picture opens in New York City, they get the Friday matinee figures, the 2 o'clock figures, and they rate it against last year's picture, and they know whether they're winning or losing. They know immediately. So they open in 2,000 situations on a weekend. If the film doesn't do $25 million, it's not a good picture. I remember once it's in the novel, the then head of Paramount screaming at John Avildsen, who had directed Save the Tiger, the first film I had written, because he was upset that one of the ladies in the piece spoke French to her customers. And he said to John, what is that French all about? And he says, well, I don't know, it was in the script. He says, I don't want to hear about the script. Writer has nothing to do with anything. You're the director. Anything on the screen is you. The writers are a necessary evil. He shouldn't even, meaning me. He says, Shagan shouldn't even be in this meeting. He happened to co-produce this movie. But so I'm letting him sit here. I don't talk about the writer. He says, why does she speak French? He said, well, I thought it was a little autistic. And he grabbed his stomach in pain, the head of the studio. And he said, there was a whole long history of his involvement of selling films in Buffalo and here and there and epics and bad ones and good ones and all that. And he said, now, there's one thing I've come to understand. Art is a line at the box office. Everything else is inartistic. It has nothing to do with art. Art is when people line up to see a picture from where I sit. And when you think of it, because the guys that run the studios are transients, it's probably true. Because if they make a couple of bad ones, they're on the sidewalk, you know. And it's a bank. It's not a studio. It's a bank. They give the director, not the producer. The director is God. He's not the boss. He's not the chief. He's not the godfather. He's God. The director is the one they trust with the $35 million. He has got to get 145 bodies, because that's what it takes. Each one has his own act to perform, not even counting the cast. And then you have a fleet of trucks outside that you can invade Iraq with. I don't know what the hell they're all for. And he has got to watch everything. He's got to get perhaps 2 minutes of good film, usable film a day, at the cost of probably $250,000 a day to shoot. When we made Tiger, for instance, when we made Save the Tiger, there was a device called the Cinemobile, devised by an Egyptian engineer named Fuad Saeed, that had everything on that one truck. Generators, cameras, sound, lights, scrims, diffusion, anything you needed. And all it meant was you needed trailers for your stars shooting on location. A honey wagon and a food truck. And it was too practical. And they got rid of this fellow and his truck, his Cinemobile. So now it's the fleet, you know. I mean, and it's,
I see them all over Manhattan, which is one big studio lot anyway.
Yeah, I'm sure there have been a lot of detours around those guys.
Well, let's talk a little bit about a cast of thousands,
right?
Because here we talk, you talk about a movie company being a bank. In effect, that's what the company is in the novel, and the whole premise, of course, is to set up a deal for a phony takeover. A whole bunch of people are in the plot, and to assist in showing how rocky the company is, they decide to make this spectacular film that everybody knows is going to fail. But what actually happens?
Well, they have to make a mega flop in order to make the stock swindle work, in order to convince the stockholders to accept an offer, a phony offer, really, that's going to be withdrawn, that's on the table, which would give the stockholders a modest profit. But they know the company's worth perhaps 400% more than they're offering, and in order to get them to take the offer, they have to have a film that's totally out of control. I mean, thousands going down the toilet. I mean, the whole studio might go bankrupt. And by virtue of that film shooting at the same time this quasi-offer is on the table, the stockholders will grab it, you know. And that's part of the plot. And there's a mafia involvement, obviously, which really happened and almost happened at MGM. The Japanese have taken over Hollywood, the Australians, some Germans, Italians. But the mob came very close to getting MGM. So that sprung a little of the idea. There's a lot in there that's fiction, obviously, but it's based in things that have happened. And what happens is that they have to cast the film with very eclectic and dangerous people, but yet gifted people. People that had shown traces of brilliance at a time to make it look good. So they comb the Hollywood vaults and crypts and forest lawn to find even the dead have to rise up. And when they rise up in Hollywood, they're taking the lunch at Morton's, you know. It's a place where the dead do rise, you know, because they're buried warm. You know, they're still buried alive. And then when they open the crypt, they take them to Morton's, you know. They wash them up, clean them up, and take them to lunch. So they people the film with very, very eclectic stars and a director who's run away from it all by because he experimented. He was once terrific, and he experimented with a form, tried to expand it, the parameters of it, and stylistically, and impressionism, and expressionism, so on and so on. No one understood what the hell he was doing except Gene Siskel, you know, who called it a virtuoso in postmodern expressionism, which means nothing. Nobody knows what it means. And he got fed up with it all, was married to a very beautiful actress, and took his cat called Honey Bear and ran off to the jungles of Ocho Rios, where he lives in a villa and makes films in his mind every day, in his head, because nobody can recut him. Nobody can change the music. Nobody can change a word. And he's happy. And he doesn't, you know, he's going to direct this mega flop. And the guy say, well, he ran away. He's committed. Some people think he died. No one knows where he is. He says, we'll find him. He's the Paul Scott perfect guy for the picture. Then they suggest a writer to rewrite the Spanish Civil War, which is epical. And the studio chief, who has a certain charm, even though he's lethal, he's bright and he's from Broadway. And when you're from the theater, especially with a couple of Tonys in your pocket, and you come to Hollywood, there's a lot of respect for theater in Hollywood. Understatement, drives a Volkswagen Jetta, you know. And the only...
He's in on the plot.
Yeah, Harry Walters. And the only thing in his objects in his office that are evident is a poster of Ava Gardner and the Barefoot Contessa, because he worships beauty. He thinks and says that true beauty is truth at its most absolute. And the Greeks knew it because they had a lot of temples, you know, and chains of temples. They didn't have Hamburg hamlets. They had chains of temples worshiping beauty. And he gets this beautiful actress in it who's a little mad, who was married to the crazy director who's run away with his cat. And he gets somebody called Mayo Marasco, who may remind people of a certain actor who...
Well, we're almost out of time, so we can't go over each character. But
no.
They did hire a bunch of people that they didn't...
Volatile, think, very volatile.
Work well together,
right.
but something happens. It turns out that...
They can't even make a flop. In other words, the thesis of the novel, simply stated, is that no one knows what's going to work, and that every good movie is a mistake. Not an accident, it's a mistake. No one knew it was going to happen, and they can't even really design a flop. It's somebody's sheer tenacity or obsession or madness that makes a film really happen. And that's the thesis of the book, and it's kind of a Disneyland ride through a mad enterprise, and all that's real to the people who finance it is that little green ticket that pops up out of that half-inch slot, and that's real. That's $7. The rest of it is making movies. It has nothing to do with reality. And in the end, the actors aren't there. I mean, you're in a theater and a light beam is projected. The actors are in Turkey. You're in a theater in Third Avenue, you know. So the whole thing is really a surreal enterprise. It's soft goods, but you can't fix a tooth with it. You can't wear it. You can't drive it. You can't eat it. You hope somebody's going to look at it. And And if you can look at it, and you can only write about it satirically, I think. I don't think you can write about it dead on because it gets boring and torpid and lethargic. But if you have a sense of humor about it all, and you, I mean, they ship nitroglycerin to Madrid in my book, so to speak, in human beings, and they expect this terrible explosion. There are explosions, but in the end, the thing they never, never expected, and what's disastrous for them, is that the film works. It's a masterpiece. And I think, I hope that it takes the reader on this ride, you know, and they'll know a little more about it when they get through reading it.
Steve, is your work pretty well evenly divided between screenplays and novels?
I would think so, yeah. Yeah, I would think so. They're vastly different. Demands are very different, but I think so.
Tell me about some of your screenplays.
Well, going back, Save the Tiger was the first one.
Wasn't that based on your novel?
No. The screenplay came first, and it took us 2 years to get $1 million to make the picture. In that interim, I wrote the book.
So you wrote the book after the screenplay.
Right. The screenplay.
Bud Spielberg did that with Waterfront.
Right. The screenplay was sort of a structure for the book, really. And that got a lot of attention, that picture. And then I did a picture called City of Angels, the director changed the title to Hustle because he thought Angels would connote baseball for some reason. Who the hell knows? Part of the craziness. With Burt Reynolds and Catherine Deneuve, and that was very successful. And then there was another film called Voyage of the Damned, which was not fiction. It was a true story about, very sad story about a propaganda ploy by Goebbels to send 936 Jews on the Hamburg American Line SS St. Louis, ostensibly to gain entry to Cuba, to show the Western democracies they weren't interested in extermination, but merely to deportation, to cleanse the German nation of these Jews. And then bought the Cuban president not to permit the boat entry and then test everybody. And Roosevelt turned them down, Chamberlain turned them down, Blum in France, himself a Jew, turned them down. And they floated for 40 days. What interested me was the German captain of the boat, Gustav Schroeder, at a certain point got an order to return to Hamburg at flank speed, and he knew they would all be killed, and he said, no, I'm not going to do it, because my code is the code that transcends that of the Reich. It's a code of the sea, and these are my children. These are my charges, these people. And there's a moment when a man chooses not to follow orders, which put the lie to the whole Eichmann business and John Calley and all that stuff about mass murderers, you know. And I thought, boy, that's interesting. Here's a German captain that said no. And that got some Academy attention, too. And I'm very proud of that picture. I'm glad it exists. And other things, you know, on and on. And I've just finished the screenplay, as a matter of fact, this week for Paramount, called Sacred Ground, which is an original thing that I worked on with a director named William Friedkin. And which kind of is a murder mystery wrapped around the enigma of Los Angeles, the new sociology of Staten Island on the Pacific, you know. I don't think that's been done yet. No one knows the grids, the square grids that are locked off there, that have Oriental, you don't go in. Latino, you don't enter. Black, you don't enter. There's a Guatemalan section now, very dangerous, and each one has its own drug to sell, and each one has its own gangs. There are 19 or 20 people killed every weekend in L.A. I don't know if it's heard about in here in New York, but we had 1,500 gang killings last year. I mean, that's more than the Intifada, that's more than in Somalia. It's a war, ongoing. And senseless and motiveless, a lot of it. It's the joy of killing. Got to make your bones by killing somebody to get in the Crips or the Bloods or the Pachucos or whatever it is. The community that has the most order, I think, that has less senseless violence is the Korean community. And that's run by one man. I mentioned his name, a man named Mr. Kim, who's called the Baudai, who's not merely a godfather, he's an emperor. Nothing happens in that community without his approval. And it's run fairly well. And when we had the riots 6 months ago or whatever it was, he armed the Korean storekeepers. I don't know if you saw pictures of it here in the East, with automatic weapons who defended their stores. He distributed the automatic weapons. So this then you go to Bel Air and you get the whole movie thing and a different thing, and Malibu Beach and Sarah.
So your play addresses these various...
I think so. I hope it has a kind of sociological value wrapped around a murder mystery. And
I would assume, and I've heard this from many screenwriters who also write novels, that they really like their novels better because they're everything, whereas you turn over a screenplay to a director and you lose control.
If you write a screenplay, you early up your heart is broken, and then you get used to it. You know that it's a blueprint for other folks, creative committees, directors, cocaine dealers, ex-mistresses, wives, nannies, whoever, to take a shot at it, and there'll be other writers assigned to it. And when people see movies and they see multiple screenplay credits, they think all those folks work together. The contrary. If there was a godfather in Los Angeles, he'd be busy all the time with writers putting contracts on other writers, you know. They hate each other. And then there's a guild process to judge credit. You know, these are three anonymous wise men. No one involved in the arbitration, none of the six writers know who these three people are, and they judge who gets credit and in what position. It's an imperfect process, but that's the best we can do. And it's up for grabs. The film where your words and your thoughts and the thrust of your piece is maintained, if you have one or two in a lifetime, you're rich. Most of them are distorted, and you just have to walk away, take the dough, and run. Next. Next is the key word to stay alive mentally, healthy, physically healthy in Hollywood. You have to say next. You got to forget what happened. Whereas with a novel, you're the weatherman, the wardrobe man, the makeup man, you control everything. And what's great about it is that they can't hire another writer to rewrite you. They can publish or not publish. The editor can be very helpful if he or she is bright. In this one, I had a lady who who'll be nameless, but pleasant enough. The only thing she ever said to me, one of the characters, as you know, in it, the actors has a pet python called Ruby, who has good karma. He won't go to location and film without the python. And this really happened to me. This is not apocryphal. And she'd call me about three times a week and say, Steve, I got to tell you, that python worries me. That was her contribution. That's not that she's a bad person, but, you know, but I said, no, the python has to stay in the movie. It doesn't hurt anybody. The python curls up under a tree and hisses once in a while and is largely bored with the whole exercise of filmmaking, but he's on the set.
Well, Cast of Thousands is a very funny book, and also you can learn a lot about the motion picture industry. I certainly did. I still don't know what a Foley grip is, though.
Well, if we had time, I'd tell you. A Foley is simply a guy named Foley many years ago. When you do a film, and when you're in a restaurant, let me make it simple, and you and I are having lunch, there's a certain fundamental noise in that restaurant, right? That we're unaware of, perhaps, but it's there. Other people are talking, waiters, dishes clanking, drinks being served. That's Foley, this fellow Foley said, we can't have dead track in a scene where there are other folks with something's going on. So what he did was he would take what is called Walla Wallas. He'd make soundtracks of folks in the room, of dishes, of clanking, of drinks, of whatever, and you'd lay that in when you mix the soundtracks. That's a Foley.
I like the old days better, where you just saw a couple of credits, you know, the makeup and wardrobe and a few actors, producer, right, and director, and that was it. Now, when you see the credits, they go on for 10 minutes.
Oh, the guy that drives the honey wagon.
See the caterers and security, and various publicity people and drivers and all of that. Why do they all have to have mention anyway?
I think it's something that happened with the IATSE, the union, the International Alliance of Theatrical and Stage Employees, when the Teamsters, I think, got involved in that. I don't know. And then the studios
caterers?
Like...
Caterers? And florists?
And also the guy that drives the toilet truck. That's the honey wagon, as we call it in Hollywood. He gets credit. Honey wagon by Charlie Honey Wagon. So he gets credit. I think what happened was the studio fellas thought, gee, it makes it look like we used a lot of people, and this is a big picture, and it shows we spent a lot of money. I think they began to get flattered by all that, you know. In my mind, in my analysis, I think the more the merrier.
Well, Steve, it'd be fun taking a cross-country trip on an airplane seated next to you. You have a lot of stories to tell. Fun talking to you.
Thank you very much for the chance.